We have 5 weeks left in 2018, and we need $103,000 to cover our expenses for the year. Please consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift to support this worldwide outreach. You can contribute by check, make your check payable to Issues, etc., and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us at the end of 2018. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Navigating social media is difficult. It is hard to understand, especially when the rules are ever-changing. And if you've been on Twitter lately, you've noticed that some of the rules have changed. There have been people banned. There have been famous people banned. Sometimes they return, sometimes they do not. Twitter is not always completely forthcoming with the reasons why someone is banned or temporarily taken out of commission. But they do have a new set of rules that they're very clear about. They have to do with, well, there are two terms here, dead naming and misgendering. That is not allowed, and that can be grounds for temporary or a permanent ban from that social media platform. We're going to be talking about Twitter's new speech rules on transgenderism. Pastor Hans Feeney joins us. He's pastor of River of Life Lutheran Church in Shanahan, Illinois. He's creator of a series of comical videos called Lutheran Satire and a senior contributor to The Federalist, where he has written a column, Twitter's new trans speech rules emanate from religious extremism. Hans, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So do you think you could do Jack Dorsey's job better?
In a general sense, no. I'm not at all well-equipped for such a job. As I say in the piece about kind of this issue, that running a social media platform is sort of a tough gig because your business plan is to just hand a megaphone to any lunatic who happens to have access to the internet and just let them say whatever it is that they want to say. So on the one hand, I suppose I would be better at, since I don't have an ideological bias against conservatives, I would certainly, in kind of the specifics, do a better job, I suppose, of not permitting or not seeking out to silence their voices. But in a general sense of knowing how to run a giant social media platform, knowing where the line is when you're crossing from this is an acceptable opinion to express and this is not an acceptable way to express it or whatever it might be, that's certainly not something that I'm cut out for.
Define a few terms for us that play into Twitter's new speech rules regarding transgenderism. The first one is misgendering. What does that mean?
Right, yeah. Misgendering probably exists as a word before this, but it would have been something like if you're learning German, or Spanish, in a language where more words have gender than they do in English, and you get confused as to whether this is a feminine word or a masculine word, or in German they have neuter, so the middle category. That, I suppose, in the past would have been what misgendering was. But now misgendering is the term that leftists are using for if a biological male has decided that he is female, desires that you use those pronouns for him, simply referring to him with masculine pronouns as I'm doing for this hypothetical person, that would be an act of misgendering. So the example I give in the piece is if you just simply point out that the human person who won the men's decathlon at the 1976 Summer Olympics, that the person who won the men's decathlon was a he, that would be an example of misgendering.
Okay, and the other term is dead naming.
Yeah, dead naming, that, first of all, which sounds so much cooler than it actually is. Like, dead name, I think, would be a really great heavy metal band name. But dead naming is not nearly as cool as it sounds. It's just the idea that if the human person who was born and has with male genitalia and was given the name Bruce Jenner by his parents, if you refer to him as Caitlin, and using the name that he cast off when he adopted his female expression of himself, or whatever you would want to call it, that would be dead naming. So using the names that people have cast aside that they say no longer represent them.
So let's walk through some of the illogic or the twisted logic of this notion of this behind Twitter's let's just say for the sake of argument, it's a well-intentioned attempt to keep people from being unintentionally mocked or ridiculed on their social media platform. What's the logic behind this notion of gender in particular, and how it is now, you say, an act of faith?
Yeah, the general argument made by folks who make these kind of rules that Twitter's making, or who kind of are sympathetic towards them, is basically that it's kind of tied in with this idea of, with noting that, you know, the suicide rates of people who identify as transgender are through the roof. They are, I think I've seen these numbers, I think their rates of suicide are higher than people who were victims of concentration camps. So the mindset is that the reason this is happening is entirely because of being socially ostracized and because of social rejection. And so to deliberately misgender a person or to deadname them is an act of cruelty, it's an act of oppression, it's an act of bigotry. It's the mindset is basically that it's meant to demean and humiliate people in the same way that using racial epithets would be. So that's kind of the idea, is it's this attempt to sort of treat using the pronouns that correspond with a person's anatomy and using the name that that person was given at birth, doing that is equated with essentially, you know, throwing the N-word at someone or something of that nature. And you know, when it comes to me saying that this is basically this is a doctrine of faith, my point in all of this is, if you're going to make the argument that it is morally wrong to misgender someone or to deadname them, that it's morally wrong to not treat someone as the gender they believe themselves to be, you have to first prove that human beings have a gender, that gender identity is a real thing. And that's not something that you can prove, because gender is not rooted in biology, as you know, transgender advocates will tell us. It has nothing to do with your anatomy, has nothing to do with your chromosomes, nothing to do with any of that. It's simply an inner feeling and an inner understanding of who you are. It's a purely metaphysical thing that you can't put under a microscope and look at. So in other words, the idea that people have to say that people have a gender is kind of equivalent to saying that people have a soul. It's something that you believe, but it's not something that you can prove. And so trying to craft a whole bunch of rules around a metaphysical presumption and around basically a doctrinal assertion without any kind of natural facts in evidence is a giant exercise in begging the question and presuming that your own conclusion is already true. And it's a giant exercise in essentially forcing your religious beliefs on other people and forcing them to behave in such a way that humans having a gender is somehow conclusively proven.
You use the example of poor Bill, who sincerely believes that Ella is his soulmate. How does that go?
Yeah, so the point of the example is that when issues aren't politically charged, it's pretty easy for people of all kind of political stripes to see them fairly clearly. And it's only when there's some kind of bias that comes in that causes us to not apply the same standard that we would to this thing over here that we would to another similar thing over there. And so my example of this is the idea of the concept of soulmates is, again, entirely a philosophical or spiritual or religious belief. Soulmates isn't taught by the scriptures, but certainly, but it's something that you believe in. There's no proof for it. You can't, you know, give two people a genetic test and then determine from that they're soulmates. So if a guy named Bill says to you, "Oh man, I met this girl Ella, and she's my soulmate," you'd go, "Oh well, that's nice. That's a lovely idea. What a sweet thing to think. You know, what a nice belief to have." But then Bill comes back to you and he goes, "Well, she ended up marrying this other guy named Dave." And you go, "Oh, I'm sorry, that stinks." And he goes, "Yeah, so I'm going to sue Dave." And you go, "Well, what do you mean sue him for what?" And he goes, "Well, since Ella is my soulmate, I'm going to sue Dave for violating my civil rights by alienating my soulmate from me." And you look at him and you kind of say, "Look, dude, you can believe that she's your soulmate, but you can't force everyone else to believe it. You can't force them to live their lives according to a belief that's not in any way, shape, or form confirmable." So this is something we kind of recognize about, you know, the structure of the American government and the First Amendment, that there are certain things that can very well be born from religious conviction, but that we don't make laws based on them if the only way that you can know those things is through, you know, divine revelation or however you're going to label it. So, for example, we can say, all right, murder is wrong, that we can have a Christian reason for saying that murder is wrong. We can have a Christian reason for saying that abortion is wrong or slavery is wrong. But we also have natural law arguments that we can point to. We can show how it is that human life begins at conception. We can show how it is that taking a human's life ends, you know, the existence of that organism. We can show how it is that slavery is harmful to people. There are, you know, actual measurable ways where we can show that through, you know, natural law and through kind of just scientific observation. But you don't know from natural law, for example, that it's wrong to deny the Trinity. The only way you know that is through divine revelation. And kind of the great American experiment, and I think what we have found, the system that works best out of any other system in the history of the world for both the church as well as for individuals, is that you just simply don't impose doctrines that are only known through inspiration on other people. You can force other people to not murder, but you can't force people to baptize their babies or worship the Trinity. And it's really ought to be the same thing with regard to gender. You can believe it. You are certainly free to believe that people have a gender identity. You can even believe that it's a sin, however you define sin, to dead name people or to misgender them. But it's absolute societal chaos if you take a doctrinal assertion and a metaphysical presumption that can't remotely be proven and force every other human being to abide by it. So it certainly would just be outright theocratic tyranny if the state tried to do that. If the state made laws where you were subject to fines or prison if you misgendered someone. But likewise, even in kind of the semi-private sector with a company like Twitter, no, your First Amendment rights don't necessarily apply in Twitter land, but the point is, if the reason that you're silencing people, the reason that you're threatening to drive them off the platform is because they refuse to accept a spiritual or philosophical, metaphysical presumption that you haven't proven, that's just simply an act of religious bigotry, in the same way that if Mark Zuckerberg, you know, converted to Mormonism and started throwing people off of Facebook because they denied that Joseph Smith was a prophet.
Pastor Hans Feeney is our guest. We're talking about Twitter's speech rules regarding transgenderism. When we come back, where does the First Amendment enter here?
With religion in America continuing its historic decline over yet another year, many may wonder, how fares the LCMS? This November, the Lutheran Witness is once again shedding light on the state of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Find the latest on global mercy work, missions, membership statistics, schools, and more in this special edition. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the world through a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you in the market for a home, car, or student loan? Check out Lutheran Federal Credit Union. During November, when you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or when you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to their ministry of the month, Christian Friends of New Americans. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran FCU, good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
We're talking about Twitter's new speech rules about transgenderism. Pastor Hans Feeney is our guest. He's pastor of River of Life Lutheran Church in Chatahan, Illinois, creator of a series of comical videos called Lutheran Satire. He's a senior contributor to The Federalist and author of a recent column there titled Twitter's New Trans Speech Rules Emanate from Religious Extremism. We produced a recording of our 2018 Making the Case conferences. It contains almost 20 hours of teaching and preaching and includes Pastor Feeney's presentation, Making the Case for the Centrality of the Doctrine of Justification. We'll send you an audio DVD or a thumb drive for a year-end tax-deductible donation of $300 to Issues Etc. You can order online at issuesetc.org or make your $300 check payable to Issues, etc., send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please write audio DVD or thumb drive in the memo line of your check, a recording of the 2018 Issues, etc., Making the Case conferences. Hans, you have pointed out that Twitter is certainly, as a company, free to make its own rules about what happens in its social media platform. But where does the First Amendment enter here?
There's a piece on the Federalist that you can find today. I don't have it in front of me right now. I don't have the exact article. But it basically talks about how Twitter's kind of over a barrel here because they presented themselves as being a platform for all people. And legally speaking, when you present yourself as basically a social media platform for all opinions, then you're not considered a publisher, and because you're not a publisher, you're not liable for the things that people write on your website. If, however, you start policing things that people are writing, I suppose beyond things, you know, like death threats and things of that nature, if you start policing speech, then you stop really being a platform for free speech and you start being a publisher, which means that you're then liable for anything that that you don't ban from your website and that you allow on your website. So I think Twitter's in a bit of a rough situation here, which is probably going to come to a legal head at some point. I think with regard to the First Amendment, really I think the idea is just kind of this is as simple as this, is that the First Amendment is a good idea. I've said publicly before at a conference I spoke at a while ago, I'm happy to say it here, that God does not give us religious freedom. The First Amendment is not really at its core a biblical principle. God does not give us the freedom to be heretics. But what Christians have figured out through centuries of kind of trial and error is, sure, if you have a really faithful prince, if you have a really faithful king, then a state government can be great. It's a great way to keep heretics out of your midst and to preserve the stability of a country that's united around one confession of faith. But there have not been a lot of faithful kings and princes. And, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. And by and large, any church that's attached at the hip to the state is going to end up being corrupted by the state. So the great kind of American experiment of the First Amendment is we basically just figured out, you know what, the best way for the church to preserve her own orthodoxy is to say to the government, you're not going to be in the business of determining who's a heretic and who's not. We'll take care of that. We will trust that as long as we are protected to believe and teach that which is true, that we can win people over by convincing them and by showing the love of Christ rather than by the coercive, threatening power of the state. And I think that's a principle that private companies like Twitter should certainly abide by. So it's a tough position to get in the position of determining which beliefs are orthodox and which are not. And that is it's a tough thing for you to do. And likewise, you never want to kind of give a company or a church body or a president any power that you wouldn't kind of want your worst enemy to have. You want to have sort of a greater set of checks and balances and kind of greater room for freedom. So if you're a person who's kind of in favor of these general rules, I think it would be simple just to kind of look at things and say, you know what, it kind of works better for all of us when we all feel like we have room to speak, because then there's less hostility there, there's less anger there, which, you know, leads to less violence when people feel like they're heard and listened to. And likewise, at some point, you know, someone could take control of this institution here who might be ideologically biased against you. And so if you wouldn't want that person to drive people like you out of this platform, if you wouldn't want them silencing your voice, then you probably don't want them to do the same for people on the other side, because the tables can always be turned pretty easily.
With about a minute here, you say that more generally speaking, the left can't have it both ways. They can't be both the hero victims and the guys with the fire hoses spraying other people down. What do you mean?
Yeah, so, well, that kind of plays on a piece I wrote a little while ago, a couple years ago, talking about the idea of Selma envy, which is Selma envy is basically the idea that for younger people growing up who grew up seeing the civil rights movement and learning about it every year in school, that they want their own cause, they want their own thing to get behind, and any time they find a group that they can conceive of as a marginalized group, that's the group that they want to support. But at the same time, because the leftists kind of control America's educational system, because they control media, and because they control social media platforms, they have far more power than the people who were marching against segregation had. So they're kind of the ones in charge of the fire hoses and unleashing the dogs. And they have a tendency, once they have acquired power, to just simply do all that they can to silence the voices of any uppity heretics who don't know their place and haven't found out that they no longer, you know, belong in our educational institutions or in our social media platforms. So really, in the end, I think you just kind of look at things and you say, well, if free speech is good, it should be good for all of us. We shouldn't treat it like a tool where you use free speech to acquire power for yourself, and then you burn free speech into ashes once you've acquired power so that no one can take it away from you.
Real quick, 30 seconds. Someone says, look, Jack Dorsey just wants everybody to play nice. How do you respond?
There's a good amount of evidence that Twitter is not terribly consistent in how it applies its terms of service. So words that are considered offensive and bannable speech, if they're spoken by conservatives, are not treated the same way that they are oftentimes by liberals. Threats of violence are not treated the same if they're aimed at conservatives as they are at liberals. I have a few links in my piece kind of showing this. So there is very clearly an ideological bias against conservatives on Twitter, and the power of the ban button has definitely been used before against them in such a fashion. And with the new rules, that's probably going to happen even more so.
Pastor Hans Feeney is pastor of River of Life Lutheran Church in Shanahan, Illinois. He's creator of a series of comical videos called Lutheran Satire. He's senior contributor to The Federalist and author of a column titled Twitter's New Trans Speech Rules Emanate from Religious Extremism. You'll find a link to it at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Hans, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
In Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., we're going to reintroduce ourselves to the Advent season. It is upon us. It is a season of repentance. It is definitely pre-Christmas. We'll talk about all that with Dr. Ken Scher.
Old theology, new technology. You're listening to Issues, Etc.